the Shia LaBeouf podcast. This is episode 2, Nymphomaniac, volumes 1 and 2, from 2013, directed by Lars von Trier. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski, and this one is the only one that technically, I guess, Shia sort of did out of order for his marathon, because he watched 1 and then 2. He didn't watch 2 then 1. Like, he went, even though he was going from new to old, he still did 1 then 2. So it was in the right chronology, but boring detail out of the way. This movie was 5 hours long. No, 5.5. I'm sorry, 5.5 hours long.
Yep.
It's so difficult to get through for so many reasons.
Yes, totally agree. And I would understand why he would watch this in order 1-2, because if you watch this 2-1, it would make not very much sense. And it's pretty much just one big movie anyway, much like Kill Bill. And it's a tough one. I didn't have a lot of kind of like mixed emotions about this movie. I don't know. It's just, it's graphic, it's intense. Shia's in it. and I was thinking, Joey, like, this is like the kind of movie where I'm glad we're focusing on one actor for most of the podcast, because we could always just sort of rein it back to Shia and talk about where he is in this movie and kind of not really touch upon a lot of the other crazy stuff in detail.
Because he's really only in, I would say, maybe an hour of the movie, an hour of the 5 hours. I guess it's technically two movies, but we're going to, I guess, for simplification reasons, make everything easy, we'll just call it one movie. He's only in it for about probably an hour, but he's arguably the most important character, aside from Joe, the main girl, because Jerome, he plays this guy Jerome, or initially Jay, who is the guy who takes her virginity, and then sort of becomes like the one real love in her life, and stretches from the beginning of the movie all the way to the end, and he pops up really sort of in three different segments, three different times in her life, kind of. It was cool to see that he was such an important character that it wasn't like, you know, Stellan Skarsgård, a.k.a. Stellar Skateboard, who...
Dr. Selvig.
He's not, like, he doesn't really do much. Like, he's in the whole movie, and he's there to sort of facilitate the dialogue and the narrative and all that fun stuff, but he doesn't really do much. Like, Shia is, I think, of all the people to focus on in this movie, maybe the most interesting.
Yeah, maybe we should just briefly discuss, like, what happens, just to...
Sure.
So Skarsgård is, like, going out for tea in the middle of the night and comes upon Joe, the main character, beat up in an alleyway, and brings her back to his apartment, and as he's nursing her back to health, she's basically telling her life story, and it's about how she's a nymphomaniac. He is like a main character, but he's not. He's just like this person that she kind of tells the story to. We cut from the story to what she's telling, and yeah, I would say Shia is probably the most, like, the second most important character in the movie, even though he doesn't have as much screen time. Because to be quite honest, that stuff in the bedroom between her and Skarsgård is, like, I could have done without any of that, really. You know, like,
it
kind of seemed a little superfluous and a little more to be, like, try and add more importance to the story than what there is by getting that kind of outsider perspective. But I don't know. I didn't really find much life in that, in those sequences. I was more drawn to her story of the past and stuff.
Their stuff in the apartment, sort of the narrative that bridges everything, that sort of, you know, connects all these small stories, that's what I have the biggest problem with in this movie. Everything about it feels so contrived.
Yes.
I understand that, like, that's... It doesn't feel organic. It's... The problem I have with the storytelling is that it tries so hard to feel organic that it becomes inauthentic. Like, like, she, like, brings up... She's like, oh, that reminds me of this story. And he's like, oh, that's just like fishing. And, like, goes on, like, this whole, like, fishing metaphor. And it's just like, okay, sure. Yeah, that's fine. But you don't need that. And I feel like the only reason that the linking things are there is to sort of have, like, a narrative flow from one story to the next, but at the same time, Tarantino did that with Pulp Fiction, and Tarantino did that with Kill Bill, and, like, they don't really line up, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't necessarily, like, because they have, like, a chapter start and a chapter end, really.
Yeah.
The only reason I can sort of see it as, like, this narrative function is because at the very, very end, sort of the last minute of the movie, where he sort of makes his move, and, like, that works, I think, but I don't know if that justifies basically 40 minutes spent in conversation between the two.
Yeah, I actually didn't really buy the ending of that as much. I think you hit upon something about, like, authenticity and then the metaphor stuff. Like, her story that she's telling feels very authentic and realistic and is shot mostly that way. And then the conversation in the apartment is all metaphor. You know, she's trying to find a way to relate her story to this guy, and he's what, like a 70-year-old virgin? And in the movie, yeah. I don't know if you picked up on that. So,
there's I did.
Okay, yeah. There's like there's just all this implausibility about their conversation and stuff, and then it also does something I didn't enjoy, which kind of makes her seem like she could be an unreliable narrator, which I didn't really like, because I kind of just, as brutal and turned off I was by her life story, like, I wanted to believe that it actually happened, you know?
Yeah, like, it's her story, like, however she wants to tell it, like, that's, you know, like, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Because it would just be like, she would bring something up, I think this is what you're getting at, but, like, she would, like, bring something up, he'd be like, what? Like, that didn't happen, did it? And she's like, right. Yeah, it did. Like, why don't you believe me?
Yeah, like, I could have done without that. Like, I know I'm watching a movie, and I feel like at times he tries to make it seem like he wants you to think you're not watching a movie, but I can never not think that in my head. It just felt, you know, in a 5.5-hour movie, it just felt like it felt out of place, to be honest with me. I don't know. I understand it's, you know, it's the narrative device, she's going to tell her story, but, like, I think it would have been just as good if it ended with him finding her and in the alley, you know what I'm saying? Like, we just follow the story. Or, you know what else could have been kind of cool? Speaking of Tarantino and how this is broken up into chapters, Out of Order could have been interesting, you know? I think that might have added a little bit of, like, a break, in a way, yeah. You know, trying to figure out, you know, when this stuff is happening, as opposed to just wondering if you're going to make it through these chapters because of how graphic a lot of this film is, you know?
Well, it is a little bit out of order. I mean, it is mostly, I would say, like, 80% in order, but she does sort of flashback. She's like, okay, to understand this part of the story, we need to go back again to when I was a little girl, or, you know, we have to go back a couple years, or whatever. So, I think that there is a little bit of the breakup there in terms of mixing things up a little bit, but it would have been, I don't know. I agree that it could have, like, mixing up could have worked. I think the way that it's laid out, it works as well as it can. I don't know how well the movie works on a whole, but I think that given the story that he wants to tell and really, like, the breadth and the depth and the scope of it all, I think that what Lars von Trier puts on screen sort of works as well as it can.
Yeah, I'll say this about Lars von Trier. I may not quite enjoy his movies, but the guy can make a movie. You know, he's a... Right. I think he's a really great director. I mean, I've only seen two of his films. I've seen this, and then I've seen Melancholia, which I really liked, and is way, way less brutal than any of his other work, I'm told.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Validated. But that's the thing. Like, I would love to see him do, I don't want to say a normal movie, but I would like to see him out of his own wheelhouse, you know, maybe put, like, his depression series behind him and try and do something a little more mainstream. Is that a sin to kind of say? I mean, he is one of the most art house directors that is kind of in the mainstream. I don't know. It's just frustrating because I could tell, like, he's a great director, and I just don't like his movies.
I mean, there is something to be said that even though this is 5.5 hours long, it really, really pushes the limits of, like, how long you can pay attention. And I know that we both broke it up over 2 days, that we didn't watch 5.5 hours straight.
Oh, there is something... Actually,
I watched it all in one day?
I had to watch it all in one day.
Oh,
yeah,
my God.
I only had time this week to do that.
Well, I broke it up over 2 days, so I sort of had a little bit of a reprieve there. But there is something to be said about how, even though it's like this, really, I don't want to say, like, it's a chore to get through. It's just, like, it takes a lot of effort. But, like, mm-hmm. You never really look away unless there's something that, like, he wants to make you look away. Like, this is a movie with two abortion scenes. And the first one, by comparison, is relatively tame. The second one is unbelievably graphic. And the second one, when they screen this, I believe it was at Cannes. It might have been somewhere else. Oh, is in Denmark. When they screen the complete version in Denmark, 3 men in the audience had to be removed after they fainted during that scene. Mm. So, I mean, like, unless it's scenes like that where he's just, like, basically daring you to watch the screen, like, it keeps your attention, which is really, really, I think, a high compliment given how difficult this is to sort of get through. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, you're right. It's kind of this endurance test, and it almost tested me and my limits of film watching. You know, I was like, at first I was like, okay, this almost feels like an assignment. I really don't want to watch this movie, but we're doing all of Shia's movies. I got to watch this. Halfway through, when I was like, okay, this is a good movie, but it's just not kind of my tastes. I don't like what's really going on here. But I'm going to sound like a contradiction, but it is engaging, and I didn't turn it off. You know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't feel like I had to force myself through it in any weird way. I just kept with it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just kept with it to see where it was going, because there is, you know, if you get through part one, you definitely want to see where part two goes, and you're trying to figure out how did she end up in the alley, and there's answers that you want, and I feel like if you've got the stomach for it, you should get through what you started, and that abortion scene comes in the second movie, and
yep.
And there's a lot of just, like, you know what I think it is about that? It's just, like, all of the sex stuff, like, they show a lot of dick, they show a lot of vagina, you know, and that Von Trier is just very basic about it. He's like, this is what it is, you know? Like, society has made you turn away. It's not right. Me, you know? He's like, I'm trying to make you turn back and see. And there's nothing sacred about sexuality in this film. And there should there be? Shouldn't there be? Well, maybe. But the point of this film is, like, don't be embarrassed. Like, look at this stuff. Like, you know what I'm saying? I almost felt like he was trying to recondition me in a way of how I thought and watched movies about sex and sexuality.
So I think that the important thing that we haven't brought up yet in this podcast is that there is so much graphic, full penetration sex in this movie.
It's like porno level.
It's unmatched in any other main... Like, this is not that this is a mainstream movie, but unmatched by any other movie that, you know, I own on Blu-ray. You know, like, it's insane how much it is. And apparently it wasn't really the actors, it was digital compositions of pornographic actors onto the film actors' bodies.
Okay.
But at the same time, you know, I think we're seeing all these actors naked. I mean, like, it took, you know, we were always talking about how, like, Cage was always shirtless, but, like, here, Shy is just fully naked, like, several times, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I don't know the extent to which they replaced stuff.
Well, I feel like that's kind of the point, is there's, you know, you put something out there, like, some of it's real, some of it's fake, and you watch it, and I just kind of assumed it was all real to a certain level, like,
yeah.
Prosthetics, maybe, stuff like that, but it's not done in a way you would assume trickery on any certain shot or anything, you know, like, none of it comes across as unreal, which is jarring.
But, like, what's crazy about the way that, like, and I think he sort of, like, breaks you down because there's so much of this, is that at one point I needed to do something, so I paused the screen, and just on my TV for, like, 5 minutes was the scene where she's with the two black guys, and it's just,
yeah,
like,
the DP scene.
The DP scene, and, like, full graphic, like, they're both in her, and it's just paused on my TV, and I looked up, and I had to, like, laugh, just because I was just like, what other movie do I own where this is, none, and the answer is none, and the answer is I will never own another movie like this, but, like, it just sort of feels like, oh, like, that's something that, like, belongs on screen, right? Like, it just, I don't know, it's just, the way that he makes everything sort of, like, it's not like it's comfortable to watch, but he makes it as comfortable as it could be, sort of.
Yeah, I think I agree what you say about, like, breaking you down throughout the film, because it gets more and more sexually intense, like, as it goes along.
We should probably start talking about Shia's character, this guy Jerome, but before we do that, there's two notes about Shia in the role. Apparently Liam Hemsworth, aka Gale, turned down that part. Shia was asked to send in pictures of his penis to obtain the role, but instead of doing that, he just mailed sex tapes of him and his girlfriend having sex to Lars von Trier, and I guess that worked.
I remember that story coming out. Okay, all right.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy. Is that going into more of, like, is this his method stage of acting now that he's done with his Transformers obligations? Like, he's going to send sex tapes to audition for this? He's going to remove the tooth and become religious to play the chaplain in Fury after this?
I have no idea. I mean, he's in American Honey, which we talked about a little bit last time, so I want to know what he's doing with that. He was almost in War Dogs. That was a news story that just came out today, the day we're recording it. So I'm really having a hard time... Going backwards is going to be interesting, I think, but I'm having a hard time really pinning down where this, like, crazy level of dedication comes to these movies, when it began, and from now on into the future, now that we know that he's at this level, if he's going to continue doing that.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. I wonder if there's, like, a turning point, or if he was always just throwing himself into the role, and it depends now on the film. Like, he's just making more interesting choices. You know, he's kind of straying from the mainstream stuff now that he's got his blockbuster money. It could afford him to come do stuff like this.
I mean, what's weird is that, like, in the scope of this podcast, in, like, 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to be talking about him in, like, the Even Stevens movie and Holes, and, like, these, like he, where he's literally just a kid in a kid's movie, like, nothing beyond that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And here, it's like, you don't get further from that. I mean, you sort of hear about, like, Disney stars. I think it's a commentary on our society. Like, it's always about, like, the female Disney stars who sort of, like, you know, like Spring Breakers or whatever, you know what I mean?
Right.
But about how they, like, go bad. But here, he's sort of doing the same thing, and, like, it's, like, a different, I don't know, I feel like it's a different kind of reception, maybe because he's a guy? I don't know.
It's strange. I mean, I haven't necessarily thought of all of it as a positive thing for him, you know? Like, he's gotten a lot of crap for, you know, going this route, I feel, and, you know, people are like, oh, he's not, like, a real actor. I mean, you just get pigeonholed like that for being in too many mainstream films, like Eagle Eye and stuff. I mean, those are just kind of cookie cutter. So what's strange about it is he seems like the same actor, but he kind of doesn't, you know? Like, it almost seems like it feels like he went into a cocoon and came out as, like, this other person in a weird way, and I don't know. I feel like with this movie and with Fury, he's got the chops. Like, I feel like his chops are there for him to actually... I don't want this to happen, but I'm just saying, if they were doing, like, an Ocean's, you know, 14, I mean, Shia LaBeouf, like, hanging with Clooney and Brad Pitt, I could see that, you know? I mean, especially since Fury, but I could see him being asked to, like, join these bigger ensembles that'll really raise him up to A-plus status and stuff like that.
Because, like, it is sort of in a way, and I think these two movies, the first two movies that we've done, have really highlighted this, but he's sort of, like, just a tremendous character actor in, like, both definitions of the word, like, in the small part role and also in, like, the sort of, like, a chameleon could play anything. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know that he's necessarily leading man potential. Like, I don't know if he's not, like, I mean, we'll get to, like, the Transformers movies and iRobot, and, or, I mean, he's not the lead in iRobot, but we'll get to the Transformers movies, we'll get to Eagle Eye, we'll get to Disturbia, where he's, like, supposed to be, you know, this leading guy, and we'll see how he does. But, like, I'd rather have him in an ensemble movie, whether it maybe is a star like Brad Pitt, or maybe there's, like, a central focus like Charlotte Gainsbourg in this movie, have him be, like, a really interesting character, shows up, like, you know, like Cage in some of his, like, early to mid-films, where he's, like, the bad, you know what I mean? Like, if he's the bad guy, he just shows up, he's on screen for 45 minutes, and, like, indisputably the best part of all those movies, you know what I mean? It's just, like, that's the kind of thing that I want him to do, and I feel like that might be what he's trying to do, that he's taking bigger chances and taking bigger risks and doing these movies that, like, he doesn't necessarily, like, I'm sure that he's set financially for life, so, you know, if he wants to be this guy who just does, like, really daring things and just, you know, has, like, these, like, works with, like, all the crazy art house directors, like, cool, like, that's exciting.
Yeah, and I think Von Trier is a good match for him because he's used American stars before in his foreign films, and Uma Thurman's in this for a hot second, Kirsten Dunst is in Melancholia, and you got Willem Dafoe's in a lot of his movies. So this,
including this one.
Yeah, including this one for a minute. So I feel like this was also a good match for him directorially, and I feel like he does a good job in this movie. Now, I'm going to bring up something that caught me completely off guard. His accent. You know, this movie takes place in England, I think.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure.
Honestly don't know. It's somewhere Western Europe.
Mm-hmm. Shia's got an accent. At first, I was like, what is that? You know, like, what's going on? What's he trying to do? Don't tell me he's going to do this the whole movie. And then he kind of disappears for an hour, and when he shows back up, I don't really even notice the accent. I'm more into him on screen as a presence and as a character showing back up again in the story and stuff that I even bought his accent by the end of this movie.
What's weird about a movie that's 5.5 hours long is you can have a guy like Shia show up half an hour, 45 minutes into this movie as this pivotal character, this guy who basically just had a moped and was sort of this cool older kid in town, and she went to have him take her virginity, and he does. He does the 3 thrusts and then the 5 thrusts, and he's done. Those are huge numbers in this movie, I guess, because, you know, they show him on screen a couple times.
Yeah.
And then, like, because it's 5.5 hours of story, he's able to disappear for an hour and a half. And then I was like, I knew in my brain that it was Shia with the moped. But then when he was gone for so long, I was like, wait, was that not Shia? Because then he shows up again as her boss. I was just like, oh, okay, like, quote-unquote normal movies, like, movies that are, like, 2 hours long, like, I don't think, you're not afforded the luxury of having, like, this, like, sweeping, lifelong narrative. I mean, it even gets to the point where the final time we see his character, he's not even the actor anymore. Like, it's an older guy sort of playing, like, an adult Shia that we saw, like, for Cage Club, we saw a couple times young Cage, but we never saw older Cage. Like, we never saw Cage in the future. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was just, this is something, like, I don't really, you know, I don't know how many times I've seen Charlotte Gainsbourg plays her character sort of the back third of the movie, but the first two-thirds, like, there's a younger actress, and then an actress who sort of plays the range of, like, I don't know, what would you say, like, 14 to 30, kind of?
Yeah.
It's weird, and, like, I guess I'm sort of straying from your point about the accent, but, like, it is, like, there's so much that this movie does that to see him, like, sort of focus on his accent and focus on, like, these little, like, character eccentricities early on in his first appearance, that by the time he comes back around, we're so into the movie that we're just like, we don't really care that it's Shia anymore. We're just like, okay, what's Joe doing in this situation? Like, how is she going to, you know, what is this going to mean for her life?
Yeah, one thing I really like about this movie and about Von Trier is the way he treats, like, casting his characters, because to him, they're just the character. You know, multiple people can play this person in their lifetime, and they don't even have to look very much like their right. previous version. What he does with Shia, though, is pretty much uses him throughout the entire movie, you know, spans, like, four decades of his character, and we, like you say, for the Joe character, we get, like, four or five girls playing her, but for Shia, we get basically him and this other guy for like 3 minutes at the very, very end. And it's very strange because, you know, old age makeup, it just goes back to like the first year of movie making. It's like, usually you cast a different person to play the younger you, but you put the main actor for that character in old age makeup. This is definitely the first time in a very, you know, recent memory that I could recall them recasting older like that, and it's fine though, because to me, like you say, when he shows back up, he's not really Shy, he's just the character, he's Jerome, you know, right. And then I like that about this movie, and I was able to buy into that.
This is an exaggeration considering the big content of this movie, but I was gonna say, what was the most jarring thing about it, or like one of the first jarring things, was how young he looks?
Yes.
Because we just saw him in Fury, and he probably looks older than he might ever in his life. You know what I mean? Just because, like, with, like, just war, like, grizzled from war, with that, like, old-timey, like, old man mustache, and, you know, missing teeth and scars on his face, and just, like, he just looks like he's, like, he's just seen some shit. But here, you know, the first time we see him, he's, like, clean-shaven, and he's, you know, playing a boy who's, like, 17 or 18, and he's just, they do a good job of, like, the way that, like, they have his hair and his face and his clothes, that, like, he's like, shockingly young, and I was just like, oh! And then when he shows up again for sort of the main part of the movie, which spans, I don't know, what would you say, like, 5 or 10 years, probably, of, like, them at work, and then when they sort of, well, no, because I guess he comes back later. Like, it spans a while, but, like, he sort of looks more like him, but, like we were saying, it's like, okay, like, cool, we already know it's Shia, like, let's just see, like, what Jerome's up to. And then, you know, he has the whole thing where he's her boss, and then he leaves again for another, like, 45 minutes. Like, it just, like, this movie does so many things with just, like, telling story and just, like, yanking him out. And I think it's interesting to watch it just focusing on the one character, because there's just so much that happens between his scenes that really the only constant in this movie is Joe, and everything else aside from her, it doesn't matter. Like, it's not, like, they're not forcing him to be in the movie because he's sort of the second lead. Like, he's just not in her life, so he's not going to be around.
So I just thought of a really, like, pretentious theory about this all, if I may. And, like, believe me, I don't feel that great for coming up with this, but it just popped into my head. Joe is telling this story, right? And she... Yeah. And he is her first time, and basically she's been in love with him ever since that time, right?
Right.
And the only time Shia isn't playing Jerome is at the very end, when Jerome sees her and beats the shit out of her, and he looks different. So she's just remembering him that way. You know what I'm saying? That's why he hasn't switched character. So,
or like, alternatively, in the same sort of theory, is that, like, she almost doesn't recognize this man because he treats her so differently.
Yes, yes.
So it's either it's just all. I like that. I like that. But also, like, I guess in that regard, no, I mean, I don't know. I would almost say that, like, when Stellan Skarsgård comes back into the room at the end, after he's like, I'll make sure you're not disturbed, and then he basically comes in to try to have sex with her at the very, very end, if that was true, and if you want to sort of be, but that's sort of more obvious, like, you could have him, like, look different, you know what I mean? Like, he sort of comes back as, like, a monster, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But I don't know, I guess that's also...
Just
that's
throwing
also,
it out there.
No, I like that. I'm just trying to see if that, like, that would sort of apply anywhere else in the story. But no, I like that a lot.
I think the only other man in her life that really meant anything to her was her father, played by Christian Slater. Hey, good to see Christian Slater, you know, believe it or not. Wind Talkers got his head chopped off, got it sewed back on for this. And he looks the same too. And I mean, I didn't think of any of this watching the movie. I was just like, oh, it's Christian Slater. But he doesn't really appear to age, although he kind of dies when she's like in her 20s or something. So he doesn't really have a chance to age too much on screen. But I don't know. That was the only other thing I'd reach for is like, well, he never really changed in appearance, but most of the other people in her life were recast to look different.
Like, the Christian Slater stuff, like, there's, like, entire chunks of this movie that, like, I don't really get behind, but sort of feels like a little bit of, like, a distraction, kind of. But it also, like, by the, like, it's weird. Like, I don't like this movie, I don't think. But I don't...
It's a good movie, though. That's the issue, right?
But it wins me over, yeah.
Like, I don't like it either, and I don't really like that I like it at times. And, you know, at the beginning of this, we were really down on it. And, like, by the end of this, it's going to sound like we're praising it, but I don't want you to feel that way.
Because, like, there's, like, the whole... It's, like, half an hour... Actually, I don't know. Like, when I use these times, like, I don't know. Everything feels so long. Like, it's just, like... Because really only... There's 8 chapters that span 5.5 hours. And the first 2.5 hours of the movie, the first Nymphomaniac Volume 1, is 5 chapters. They're like 5 shorter chapters. And then the second movie is 3 longer chapters.
Yeah.
And so one of the chapters in the first one, so probably about 30 minutes, is Christian Slater dying in the hospital. By then, I was just like, this isn't really about her, and this is, you know... Like, I understand, like, it's going to become about her, but, like, I was like, this is... It sort of feels like we're straying. But then by the end of it, the way that they weave it back into the narrative and the way it becomes, like, her sort of dealing with grief, that works. And then, like, later in the movie, in the second part, one of the longer sections is when she becomes sort of that, like, I don't know, like, debt collector for, like, the mafia, basically.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, this doesn't feel like it has anything to do with it either. But, like, it's also just, like, a natural extension of her character. It's really not about her and sex addiction. It's really just about her, and most of her life is about sex addiction. You know what I mean? I think it depends on how you want to think about it. Like, things feel like they're out of place, but, like, everything works.
Some of my favorite stuff was the Christian Slater stuff, actually, just because it was, like, this respite from, like, this nihilistic sexual stuff that was also going on in the film. There's just something about the way, especially the hospital sequence was shot, I really liked. I don't know what it was that I could put my finger on. I don't know if you caught that he shoots every chapter in a different type of film. Like each chapter is shot with, like, a different film stock, or he does something to it to make it look separate in some way, aspect ratio or something. And that hospital sequence was all black and white. I just felt like the most sincere part of it to me. It felt like the part where he wasn't struggling to make a point. It just, you know, it just felt like the most easy going. It's weird. I know. It sounds strange to, like, say that watching Christian Slater die with dementia and her...
Die painfully.
I mean, it's strange to say, like, that's my favorite part of the movie, but there's just something, like, incredibly well done about all that with, like, the dignity that he shot it with and everything. I don't know. That got the emotional response out of me, not, like, the rest of the stuff. The rest of the stuff was just, like, way too shocking.
I think my favorite scene in the movie... I don't know what my favorite chapter was. I think my favorite scene, I don't even know how to describe it, because I don't want to describe it, but it's when they're at the restaurant and Shia offers her $5 to put the spoon, and then she just grabs all the spoons. Tonally, it's just so different from everything else that, like, and I guess that's sort of the point, right? It's this one positive moment that she has with Shia, because so much of their relationship is, like, bad or sour or negative in one way or another, and, like, this is a pleasant, positive memory, and it's just, like, a 3-minute scene, but it's, like, the only, or one of the only, like, funny scenes in the movie. It works beautifully. I mean, another one of the funny scenes is that double penetration scene, because, like, she basically just becomes a background character in her own story, and just, like, all right, like, I'm gonna get out of here. Like, there's these little moments of levity surrounded by, like, intensity, either in, like, graphicness or just horrible events in her life, and I just, like, these, like, 3 minutes every 2 hours that, like, he left and just, like, all right, okay, I'm okay for a little bit more.
Yeah, I could have used a few more of those. You know, it would, if her dad wasn't, like, a doctor that loved trees, it would have been great if he told her jokes instead, you know.
So chapter 2 is Jerome, and that's where we really, like, we meet Shia's character for the first time in Chapter 1, but then Chapter 2 is all about him. And, like, I'm like, okay, cool, like, we're gonna get Shia, and, like, the first thing we see is her having sex with a bunch of dudes that aren't Shia, and I was just like, oh, okay, like, that's interesting. But then we find out that he is gonna be her boss, like, she applies to be his secretary, and she has no skills, and then the girl is just like, oh, so, like, you think that you don't need skills to be a secretary? And she's like, I guess not. And then she gets the job anyway. But my favorite, like, another one of my favorite parts, and I don't think it's just because it's Shia, because we're watching for Shia, when they're just, like, walking around, he's really just belittling that blonde secretary who he eventually runs off with.
Right. And Liz, good, like, job.
Good job, Liz.
Yeah, good job, Liz. Like, that's, like, her full name.
Good job, Liz.
And he's like, that's her full name. Good job, Liz.
But then, you know, he leaves with her, and they're sort of together for a while, you know, Joe is trying to get her life together.
What I liked about that stuff is that I loved all, like, the casualness of, like, he was happy to see her again, and, like, you remember me. He's like, I never forgot you, and it's kind of great that his character is smitten with her as well, especially because of, like, how kind of brutal their first time was.
Right.
You know, like, it was, what, like, 3 times in the front, 5 times in the back, and that was that,
yep.
And just, like, it.
No pleasure for anybody, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's kind of just like, it's one of those funnier moments when they see each other again and there's this attraction. I don't know what it is for Joe. Maybe it's, I mean, I don't know what it is for Shia, but I believe it's for Joe. It's like getting back to her roots in a way. Like, this is my first time. Like, this is going to be kind of an interesting thing. Maybe the only guy I'll ever screw twice in my life. What I also liked is that Jerome tries to, like, put the moves on her, and she's not down whatsoever.
Right.
And it becomes, like, this kind of sexual tension between them, like, sexual for her to sort of lead him on in a way and to, like, irritate him. I don't know. I just like the back and forth that they had. They have good chemistry. That's what it is, I think. Like, and it comes out definitely in this, that the girl at this time playing Joe and Shia are really, like, bouncing off each other.
And what's weird about this part in the movie and the story is that they're almost more like a married couple before they're married.
Yeah.
Than when they're actually married. Like, they have, like, these, like, weird sort of awkward tense moments, and there's, like, these, like, weird sort of flirty moments, and, you know,
and they're not having sex, right? Like a married couple.
He's into her and she's not reciprocating, and then as soon as she's like, oh no, like, I'm actually in love with him, and she writes him the letter, then he's just gone. And so it's like this, it's sort of like a, you know, like Craigslist misconnection. We're just like, oh, like, is she ever gonna get back with the love of her life? And then it takes, you know, another half an hour in the movie for him to come back, but, like, it sort of devastates her and sort of sends her spiraling down.
Yeah, I equated it to sort of, like, just about the climax and then, like, getting a phone call or something and interrupted and not being able to reach it, and she's just about to embrace love for the first time, and, you know, she's not herself. She wrote this letter. She's like a giddy little schoolgirl in her mind, and this is just not who she is, you know? And then suddenly, like, right at the moment where she's ready to accept herself as that person, like, he's gone, you know? Yep. And, like, she has to tumble all the way back down that hill for the next part of the movie.
But then he shows up sort of triumphantly at the end of the first part. She tells him to fill all of her holes, and they have sort of a... I was thinking, like, while I was watching this, I was like, are we going to call this, like, compromising or sipping Miss McGill's tea? Or just, like, no, like, it's just Shia having sex. Like, there's nothing, like, you really can't dumb down or sort of, like, PG this discussion, because it's just, like, the things that they say and, like, the things that they do, it's just, like, you can't tame it down. It's sort of, I guess, the ultimate irony that, you know, he comes back and they're ready to have a relationship, and then sort of all of her years of sleeping around have destroyed her body, kind of, and she can't feel anything, like, she has no sexual pleasure anymore, and that's the end of part one, that, like, you know, her nymphomania has ruined her life, because now that she's finally ready to settle down, the thing that she loves most with the person she loves the most, it just can't happen.
Yeah, and that was kind of like a huge cliffhanger, believe it or not, like at the end of part one. I was like, oh, that's intriguing. Yeah, and I don't know what it is. Is it like she finally got what she wants and she's like psychologically like punishing herself for it, or has she really lost all sensation, or what is it? It's a very interesting turn that I wasn't expecting, and I would say if part one is about pleasure, part two is much about pain and her trying to just feel anything emotionally and physically, and, you know, trying to regain that.
What the movie does, or I think it's Lars von Trier sort of like winking at us a little bit, because Stellan Skarsgård, when he hears about this and about how she can't feel anything, and like this is sort of the most pivotal time in her life, he's like, oh, it's just like Zeno's paradox. You are Achilles and the tortoise is the orgasm. And about how, like, you'll never catch up and pass. And then I was just like, oh, this is, like, the most pretentious metaphor. And then Joe, like, calls him out. She's like, that's stupid. Like, what are you talking about? And I feel like that's kind of Lars von Trier saying, like, we get that Stellan Skarsgård's a little bit pretentious, and I don't really like him either. But, like, he's just here to sort of move things along. But, like, we get that he's sort of, like, you know, an object. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that stuff really starts to feel kind of comical in the second volume, because, like, she constantly starts calling him out, and that's when he's like, oh, there's too many coincidences, and there's nothing in my room for you to, like, relate your story towards me about, because I can't understand what you're talking about. It's like they're looking around the room, and she sees, like, a painting, and she's like, oh, I'll relate my story to you as it's that painting. And then there's, like, music playing, and she's like, oh, I'll relate my sex life to you as if it was that music. And it's just, like, I couldn't really put up with it after a point, because, like you said, like, the character, like, the movie calls itself out. There's one amazing moment, actually, that kind of relates to this, and I think it might actually prove you're right, is right before the mirror chapter, I think it is, or something, like, there's a shot of a mirror on the wall, and you can see the film crew in it, and it's clearly intentional, you know, and it's clearly breaking the fourth wall, and I almost thought it was like, is that von Trier wondering if I'm still watching? Because it's in there to break the fourth wall. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because, like, I was so thrown off by that. Because you see, like, it's not like you catch the camera in the corner of the mirror. The camera is the entirety of the mirror. Like, it's just like, here's the cameraman. And then, like, two shots later, we just see Joe in the mirror. And, like, we're sort of back to a movie. Yeah. But it's like, it's basically exactly what you said. Like, hey, you're still paying attention, right? Like, you didn't fall asleep, right?
And again, I don't want to say this movie ever wins me over, but I think it's moments like this that prove it's a good film, because it's good at making its point, even if it becomes redundant to a degree by the end of 5.5 hours. It's like, I think this could have been cut down to, you know, 2.5 hours and still have been a really good movie and proved its point. But it's just like excess upon excess, and as much as it works and as much as he's good at it, it just becomes, you know, too much and too repetitive, and it's like, we get it. I think we get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm glad that this movie exists in the form that it exists. I'm glad that we've seen it. I'm glad that we're done talking about it, basically. I don't really know where in this sequence it would sort of come, because, like, I feel like if it came in the middle, it would just be like this, like, unbearable hurdle to get over. I feel like up front, when we still have a lot of energy about Shia, I think it's a good time to have it. I like that it's a 5.5 hour cut. I like that if you want, you can watch the theatrical cuts, even though I don't know how many theaters, like, theatrical cut, like, I mean, they're each, so basically, I think the theatrical cuts are, like, 2 hours each, so the director's cut adds 30 minutes to the first part, and adds 1 hour to the second part. So, it is sort of condensed, you can see it. I don't remember what the differences are, to be honest. I remembered most of this, but, like, the things I didn't remember, I wasn't sure if it was new or just things I forgot, like, but all, I remember, like, the most graphic stuff, I think, is all in the theatrical cut as well. I guess sort of for our purposes, for Shia purposes, you know, the film is a little bit overlong, because even though he's in this back half of this movie, you know, the function of his character here is to sort of become distant from Joe. He sort of gets tired of having sex with her, not like because he's less attractive, but just like, you know, it's like a full-time job satiating this nymphomaniac, and he's like, I need you, like, we have a dog now, basically, like, you need to feed, or no, we have a tiger, right? He's like, you need to feed the tiger, like, go around and sleep around with other men, and he just sort of, like, falls into the background. And then when she sort of goes a little bit overboard, he's like, I've had enough, and he leaves. The whole back half of the movie, you know, he's still really important, but it's not really about him anymore. Like, it's about her and, you know, her struggles and her addictions and stuff.
Yeah, her focus is away from him, and therefore the movie's focus is away from him. And he's really only in it the bare necessity. She really starts getting into S&M and bondage and starts going to see this, you know, guy that whips her, but he can only see her, like, in the really early hours of the morning, like, in the a.m. hours.
She starts to go see the Thing from Fantastic Four.
Oh, is that who? Oh,
Jamie Bell.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Unrecognizable as the Thing. He's good in this, too. Like, he's intense and scary and also kind of, like, I trust him in a weird way. I don't know. I don't want to get into his whole thing, but basically, she ends up leaving their son alone all night long.
With the door open.
with the door open, yeah, and it's snowing, and they live in an apartment building way up high, so, you know, not a good combination of things. And then Shia comes home from a business trip early and sees the kid, like, about to fall off the balcony. He's like, it's either us or nothing. Like, if you keep going out, if you go out tonight to do your S&M stuff,
well,
like, that's it.
Because it's Christmas, right? And he's just like, if you leave if you leave today, you're never going to see us again. And she's like, okay, I get it. And then she leaves anyway. And it's just like, oh, okay. I don't think she really wants to go. Like, it's not like she's doing it to defy Shia. She just, you know, she's sick and she has to go.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with that, too. I think it's just, like, compulsory for her. Like, she can't help herself. And I almost wondered if Shia would even be with her if they hadn't had that kid. You know what I'm saying? Like, he almost seems like at that point, like, I'm going to be the good man or something. Like, I'm going to be the responsible guy. And, you know, we have a kid now, so I'm going to try and make it work. And she just seems to have, like, no interest in, like, being a family whatsoever.
I'm honestly surprised, and I guess that's sort of the point. Like, they don't really need justification, but, like, she gets pregnant twice in this movie. She has the one kid, and she gives herself the abortion, which we didn't, I don't think we said, but she gives herself the abortion.
Yeah, I knew that. I knew, you know, I just knew, like, from the first, when she's in med school in the first half and she's learning the abortion, I knew that it was coming. Like, I hadn't heard about it, but I just knew it had to come back, but I didn't think it was going to, I just thought she was going to have an abortion. I did not think she'd give herself one.
Well, she tries to get one, and then the woman's like, do you love the father? And I would be, like, it's the same as, like, I don't know if I would go as far as her and be like, you know, do it to myself, but she's just like, why do you need to know all this? Like, it's my choice. What's going to help me get this abortion? Like, if I love the father, if I don't love the father, if I don't know who the father is, because I have sex with lots of men. And the woman just like, I don't know how to read. Like, she just doesn't talk, and Joe leaves. But, like, what I was saying was that it's just weird how, like, she's got this one central drive, this one central focus in her life, which is sex, and sort of empty sex, really. And yet she gets pregnant twice because she, like, gets lazy with her birth control. Like, it just sort of seems like a plot device, you know? It's like, there's no way that someone who is having sex with maybe 10 guys a day at different points in this movie is ever going to sort of forget to do the one thing that, like, could really, like, mess up her life more than anything else.
You're sounding a little like Stellan Skarsgård now. You can't believe the inconsistencies of her story here.
Which also makes me wonder if maybe she thought that she wanted to have a kid with Shia. Like, I can see that. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't think the second one was intentional. I don't know.
Well, she said something about when she gave birth, she demanded the C-section because she didn't want to, like, mess up herself.
Basically muck up the pipes, yeah.
Right, like, she's totally selfish about all that kind of stuff. So, like, yeah. To me, I bet it was something more like, okay, if I have this kid, he'll stay with me and we'll be secure and I can figure out if I love him and all that, you know, whatever. I can figure out my next step, but at least I'll have security. Because, like, when they're married, that's when she has the threesome with the two guys that she can't even, like, they're these guys on the street corner who don't even speak English, and she has, like, this rando stranger facilitate, like, a third-party meetup at some hotel room for the DP action. And it's just, like, that's what she does while she's married to Shia? Oh, man.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily get the impression that Shia's out there really screwing around, you know?
No.
I mean, he could be, but, like, it seems like he's actually working hard.
And the only thing that we really know about him after he sort of gives her the green light to go, well, we know two things about him. After he gives her the green light to go, or, like, sleep around, he starts mailing her letters addressed from other guys to sort of just see how she reacts. Like, I don't really understand that. Like, that seemed like a weird gesture. But the other thing that he did was that after they split up, he gave up his kid, he put the kid in foster home. And I think that's not necessarily, like, she says it's because the kid didn't really fit into his life, but I really think it's, like, sort of extrapolating, we don't know, but it's sort of like, I think he wants just no part of Joe anymore, and so seeing this kid around every day, like, it's not the kid's fault, but, like, it just reminds him of, like, how much of a monster the kid's mom is.
Yeah, I agree with that, too. I mean, I think by the end of the film, what he does to her, you know, when he meets her in the alleyway, pretty much justifies the fact that he never wants to see her again, hates her guts, and wishes she was dead. You know, like all of the above, basically. So, yeah, it's just more, like, there's that one shot of him sitting in the car. Remember that shot of him, like, kind of sitting in the car, looks like he's about to cry, and I'm like, is he going to blow his brains out? Like, what is this shot about? It's that it's like, I really get, like, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? It's like, I can't have, like, this being around that reminds me of this person that I hate. Like, I mean, it's no fair to the kid. I truly think it's like, I'm affording it a better life by not being the one responsible for it, because I could see him just being resentful the entire relationship.
The story's not about him. We don't really know how he lives his life after they break up. We know that he sort of gets into trouble, sort of maybe some money issues or whatever, which is why he re-enters her life at all. But, like, outside of that, like, we're just sort of left to guess and try to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, how long do you think it is till she winds up on his doorstep to collect the debt or stuff? Because, like,
I don't think it's too long, because they sort of seem to split up. I'm guessing maybe a couple years of doing sort of different stuff, and then it seems like a couple years maybe into her as a debt collector, so maybe five years?
Okay, I was thinking maybe even like a decade, because it seemed like the debt collecting stuff is some of the shortest. It's one of the shorter sequences, I feel, like all around, and it kind of comes out of nowhere, but it also seems like that's what she's done the longest in a weird way. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Willem Dafoe's like, wow, you've really built yourself an empire. And I'm like, she has? Like, we've seen her intimidate two guys.
Well, also the same thing is that, you know, she's doing it for a while, and then that girl that eventually sleeps with Shia, or not Shia, she sleeps with Jerome, I'm sorry, because it's not Shia. You know, she sort of, like, recruits her when she's 15, and then we see the girl's 16th birthday, and then they say when she was 18 she moved in. And then, you know, from there, they sort of fall in love. You know, like, it's the girl part alone is at least 3 or 4 years, if not longer. So it might be a decade. I don't know. But you can tell that, like, everything that Jerome does in that alley in terms of having sex with a girl and, like, beating up Joe, it's, like, decades of, like, pent-up rage and aggression and, like, you ruined my life, and this is just, like, I know this isn't right, but, like, there's nothing else I can do. Like, this, I need to get all this out of my system.
In a weird way, when this movie opened, I thought she was like that because she wanted to be. Like, that was her thing. Like, we would come to find out she liked sort of, like, I mean, we just recorded that episode for Zack Attack, The Paperboy, and in that, Matthew McConaughey gets into some crazy, kinky, sexy shit, too, you know? So I almost was, like, had that on my mind. Like, is this what she was into? But by the end of the movie, it's perfectly clear that no, I don't think she derived any pleasure from getting the crap kicked out of her. Yes, it is totally unforgivable and terrible what he does to her, but I almost feel like the more insulting thing, like the bigger statement, is when he has sex with the other girl, you know, because he does it exactly the way he took her virginity. He's just staring at her the whole time. That to me was almost like more crazy than the other thing. But it's all bad. I'm not saying like it's any good.
No, it's all bad. I agree with that. That's pretty much Nymphomaniac. I don't have any more notes. Is there anything else you want to talk about? I mean, there's so much we could talk about, and spoiler alert, we will for something we're doing in the future, about the movie as a movie, but in terms of the Shia role and the Jerome character, I think we did it pretty good justice. Anything else in your notes about him or the role that you wanted to mention before we wrapped up?
No, not necessarily. The only thing I think would be kind of interesting is to just kind of cut all the Shia scenes together back to back and watch that and see what the effect is and, you know, how that plays out. I think that would kind of be interesting. Like, if you don't want to suffer through this whole film, and I kind of, like, now that we're through it, I think it's, like, right, I could say it's something to suffer through. You know, I think Von Trier would be proud that I suffered through this movie.
Sure.
So, like, if you don't want to suffer through it, maybe just watch the Shia scenes and, you know, extrapolate from that what you will.
Yeah, you could do that. It would probably be between like an hour and a half, so it's sort of like a normal movie length.
There you go.
Maybe
Jerome,
a little bit shorter.
Jerome and Joe.
Jerome and Joe. So yeah, so for all things Shia, all things all his movies, you can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub. Find all the other podcasts that we're doing. You know, we're putting out one a day until this is done. You can see our other podcasts, Cage Club, Keanu Club, Zack Attack, Monkey Club, Now and Again. I mean, this is a groaning empire. I'm not going to be able to remember all these. I mean, who knows? Maybe there's another one between the time that we record this and it launches. There might be something else new. Who knows? But all sorts of stuff, all sorts of free podcast entertainment at cageclub.me and facebook.com/cageclub. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And we'll see you next time on All His Movies.